from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Eliana Biscard Church.
And I'm Caroline Batten.
This week on War News Radio, Undercover. First, we return to our investigation of Afghanistan's illicit opium economy and the second part of our two-week report.
Then, we learn about a new video game designed to portray the choices of combat journalists.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
According to a new United Nations report, violence in Afghanistan has greatly increased in the first 8 months of 2011. The report says that bombings and attacks by gunmen are up 39% from the same period last year. Complex strikes involving multiple gunmen or suicide bombers have increased by 50% since 2010. Though almost two-thirds of these attacks occurred in the south and southeast regions of the country, the violence has recently extended north, into the central provinces. The UN report raises questions of whether Afghan forces are ready to take control of the country's security. The United States-led coalition in Afghanistan disagrees with the report, saying it will soon release its own statistics.
15 people were killed and 80 injured in Karbala this week. A series of four car bombs went off near government buildings in the Shiite holy city, about 60 miles south of Baghdad. While no group has claimed responsibility for the attacks, the tactics are common to Al-Qaeda in Iraq and other extremist Sunni insurgent groups. The attacks come just 2 weeks after a bus hijacking, when 22 Shiite Karbala residents were killed traveling through the predominantly Sunni Anbar province. Tariq al-Kakani, a member of the city's provincial council, attributed the bombings to the lack of interior and defense ministers, positions that have remained vacant since the creation of a new Iraqi government last December.
Rebel forces in Libya restarted their efforts to capture Sirte, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's hometown. Anti-Gaddafi troops fought their way into the outskirts of the city and captured the airport, but since have been stalled by loyalist resistance. Rebel forces have kept the city under siege for 2 weeks, and civilian deaths continue to increase as conditions inside the city worsen. Interim Prime Minister Mahmoud Jibril asked the United Nations Security Council to unfreeze Libya's assets, as the provisional government continues to struggle with loyalist forces in Bani Walid and Sabah, as well as Sirte.
The four European members of the United Nations Security Council are pushing for a new UN resolution that would not impose sanctions on Syria. While the United States and the European Union have already imposed sanctions, the European-led initiative has faced opposition from China and Russia. The new draft resolution states that sanctions could be imposed if Syria does not respond within 15 days to demands to cease violence and permit humanitarian agencies to enter the country. The resolution was weakened to gain the support of Russia and China, which have veto power in the Security Council.
An attack on a natural gas pipeline at an Egyptian pumping station stopped the flow of fuel to Jordan and areas of Egypt this week. A number of buildings surrounding the station were damaged in the resulting explosion. At least one security guard at the station was injured. It is the third attack on the gas pipeline this month, and the sixth since the overthrow of former President Hosni Mubarak. Another section of this pipeline also reaches Israel, which typically relies on Egypt for 40% of its oil. This section, however, has been inactive since a similar attack in July, forcing Israel to find oil from other sources. Officials are blaming the strike on a militant Bedouin group in Sinai, which has been fighting for the release of Bedouin youth from prisons, as well as increased recognition from the Egyptian government.
FBI agents arrested Rezwan Fardus, a Massachusetts man accused of planning to attack the United States Pentagon using a large remote-controlled aircraft filled with C-4 explosives. Undercover U.S. agents supplied Fardus with what he believed to be explosives before arresting him. Agents claim that he planned to fly the aircraft into the Pentagon from across the Potomac River. Authorities also say that Fardus, a 26-year-old Northeastern University physics graduate, designed phone detonators intended to help Al-Qaeda militants ignite bombs in the Middle East. If he is convicted, Fardus could receive a sentence of up to 15 years in jail for supporting a foreign terrorist group, and up to 20 years for planning to attack a national defense building.
White House and State Department officials downplayed Admiral Mike Mullen's comments connecting last month's attack on the American embassy in Kabul to Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence, or the ISI. While White House Press Secretary Jay Carney acknowledged connections between the ISI and the Haqqani Network, the group claiming responsibility for the embassy attack, he did not endorse Mullen's remark that the Haqqani Network is a veritable arm of the ISI. Mullen's statements come as Congress decides how to budget aid money to Pakistan, hoping to enlist the country's resources in the fight against al-Qaeda.
Two American hikers returned to the United States after being detained in an Iranian prison since July 2009. In separate statements soon after arriving in New York City, Joshua Fattel and Shane Bauer thanked the individuals who lobbied for their release. Iranian authorities initially convicted the two of trespassing and espionage, sentencing them to 8 years in prison. The hikers have repeatedly declared their innocence and insist they were detained not because they crossed the Iraq-Iran border, but because they are Americans. The pair was also reunited with a third hiker, Sarah E. Shord, who was released in September of last year. Iranian authorities say a $500,000 bail was paid for the release of each hiker, but no one has publicly taken credit for posting the money.
This is War News Radio. Opium trade profits the insurgency in Afghanistan, and according to President Hamid Karzai, it is the single greatest challenge to long-term security, development, and effective governance in his country. But what has the government done to combat opium production? This is the second half of our report on the illicit opium economy in Afghanistan, and part of our ongoing series documenting the economy of Afghanistan and the measures required to sustain the Afghan state. This week, War News Radio's Alan Zhao further investigates the effectiveness of counter-narcotics efforts.
Once again, let's begin with the numbers. According to the United Nations Office of Drug Control, UNODC, approximately 70,000 hectares of opium poppy were cultivated in 2002. The UNODC's 2010 report estimated production at 90,000 hectares. In 2009, UNODC estimated the total value of exported heroin to be $3.4 billion U.S. dollars, approximately one-third of the nation's total GDP. Afghanistan remains the supplier of 90% of the world's opium. But the Afghan government and international partners have spent billions of dollars in counter-narcotics efforts over the past decade. Why haven't the numbers changed? Adam Payne is a rural development expert at the Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit, an independent think tank based in Kabul. According to him, the foremost problem is there simply has not been a unified effort.
It's very difficult to talk of an international effort. There has been conflict between the American position and the British position as the two key external agents in counter-narcotics. But then you have had enormous divisions within the Americans between the military, the security people, USAID, your drugs administration. They have not all seen things in the same way.
Payne says the U.S. military has been willing to support opium producers in achieving military objectives.
The U.S. military, on the other hand, have been working actively with key traders in narcotics as part of the military effort, which of course is contrary to any sort of counter-narcotic and interdiction efforts. And there's been this muddle in terms of what are the priorities, what are the goals.
For the past decade, Afghan governmental and international counter-narcotic efforts have focused on eradication. Eradication is the physical destruction of poppy plants by government forces. Paul Fishstein, agricultural expert and Harvard University Belfer Center Fellow, says that the biggest drawback is simply its inconsistent and politicized application.
So it becomes a political issue where eradicators will go out and actually eradicate opium that's either from people who, you know, are out of favor, who or otherwise don't have the political clout to be able to avoid eradication.
Gretchen Peters, an investigative reporter with a decade of experience in Afghanistan, agrees and suggests that corruption plays a major part in the eradication program.
The problem with the program was that it was quite corrupt, and so the local officials who were helping to decide which fields would get cut down would be paid off by wealthy farmers, and then they would end up destroying the fields of the poorest of the poor. And this ended up just driving hundreds, if not thousands, of farm families into the arms of the insurgency.
Eradication targeting the poor empowers the Taliban to create their own narrative of the counter-narcotics efforts. Fishstein illustrates the Taliban's propaganda victory.
There's ample evidence in a number of places that the Taliban have tried to capitalize on this by portraying themselves as the defenders of the local poor downtrodden farmers. Look, the government is at the instigation of the international community, is here to destroy your crop, but we'll help you out.
But why doesn't the government simply eradicate the entire opium crop through a total airborne eradication program? Fishstein explains the idea's impracticality.
The main concern or argument against that is, again, the counter-reaction that it provokes. I don't know what the current estimate of opium's contribution to the Afghan economy, but at some point it was estimated to be up to a half, you know, 40%, 30%. You know, certainly if you look at the economic dislocations we've had in this country, if you imagine that instead of that we had taken a 20 to 40% hit on the economy, you know, you can imagine the magnitude of the reaction.
The other major counter-narcotics effort is the development of alternative livelihoods. This practice creates alternative and legal income sources for opium farmers. Fishstein outlines the basis of the idea.
Alternative livelihood emerged. It's kind of the new generation of what started out, you know, maybe decades ago in so-called crop substitution. The idea that you would take one crop that was similar value to an illicit crop and then just farmers would substitute one for the other.
Joel Hafenstein, a former USAID contractor, offers the example of the Afghan wheat crop, where foreign donors offered free inputs to boost profitability.
Been used very extensively to try to just create a sort of single season push in which lots of farmers will plant wheat. So handing out lots of wheat seed and fertilizer, even though they know there's no way that would have an impact beyond a single season. So then you dump large amounts of wheat seed and fertilizer onto the markets. You're actually disrupting the input markets that are run for profit and that we're trying to support for the long term.
This short-sightedness, Fishstein argues, is the result of not placing opium in its rural context.
We also often treat it as just a question of let's substitute crops of similar value. This focus on whether crop X, whether it's, you know, saffron or white cumin, can provide an alternative. So there's a look for those simple solutions. But I think for opium, you really have to look at the rural economy as a whole. Opium is a very significant crop, part of an entire rural economy.
But Payne suggests that the concentration of developmental efforts in poppy-producing provinces actually encourages provinces to cultivate.
All sorts of perverse incentives have been introduced, whereby those areas which are most insecure and growing most opium have usually been rewarded by higher development and intervention efforts. And those provinces that have not grown opium or are more secure have received less. And of course, they have seen that. The incentive, therefore, is for areas which are not growing it to move back in so that they can get aid too.
Peters believes alternative livelihoods will need to be a part of any successful counter-narcotics strategy, but with other support as well.
It makes sense to have a more balanced strategy that focuses on interdiction, on public education, and on alternative livelihoods to try and help shift the communities and to be working, to be part of the solution for them to get away from the drug trade, as opposed to someone that's bringing more pain and more economic trouble into their communities.
Ultimately, Payne states, the opium economy should be understood as a result rather than a cause.
I think opium cultivation, as I said, is a symptom. It's a symptom of poverty. It's a symptom of state failure. And therefore, firstly, one has got to take a very long-term view of this. I mean, you think of Thailand, which had a much smaller drug problem, much smaller opium cultivation in the 1960s. And they took 20, 25 years to reduce it, basically by investing heavily long-term in infrastructure, support development, to bring people into the state. If it took that long for a relatively effective and capable state, you can imagine how long it's going to take in Afghanistan.
With this long view, Payne sums up the past decade of counter-narcotic efforts.
We've tried to do the wrong things too quickly in the expectation that there were quick solutions to this. They're not. The lasting solution is building an effective state that provides security and welfare.
For War News Radio, I'm Alan Zhao.
This is War News Radio. Tony Minetti, a former combat journalist who's covered conflicts in East Timor and post-Soviet Eastern Europe, was thinking of a way to simulate on-the-ground reporting for his journalism students at the University of New South Wales in Australia. From this vision comes a new video game, Warco, short for War Correspondent, that puts players behind the camera in war zones. War News Radio's Max Nesterak spoke with one of the developers of Warco to learn more about the choices that journalists are forced to make while covering combat.
It's a combat game, danger included, but instead of shooting with an AK-47, players use a video camera. The Brisbane-based video game studio Defiant Development has released the prototype of their combat game Warco, in which the protagonist is a journalist, her weapon is a video camera, and her objective is to capture the story the best she can. Players work their way through combat zones in the Middle East and Northern Africa, where they chase down leads, create stories, and broadcast their results with other players. I caught up with Defiant Development's founder, Morgan Yaffit, to ask him about the creation of the game, its objective, and how it can train new combat journalists. This is such a unique idea for a combat game. How did you come up with this?
So the original concept actually came from Tony Minetti, who has been a war journalist and currently teaches journalism in New South Wales in Australia. And he was looking at the possibilities of different ways of approaching journalism education and considered a training simulation and spoke to his friend Robert Connolly, who's a filmmaker, who started to talk about the possibilities of that actually as a game. And that's where they brought me into the mix, and we really fleshed out what the possibilities would be as both a commercial game, but something that's aimed at a bit more of a mature audience and a broader audience.
Now, it looks just like playing a first-person war game, but you're completely defenseless. What's the objective? How do you win?
The goal at any point is to go in and get a good story. So what we do is we build interactive sandboxes in which there's a number of stories for you to collect in a limited amount of time and varying amounts of danger. Your goal is to decide what sort of story you want to collect, find the footage that enables you to edit that sort of story together, and get out and proceed to the next part of the game.
Now, you've described the game as about having to navigate through a morally gray world and making decisions that have human impact. Could you give me an example of one morally gray situation the player might have to work through?
So I think these are the questions that war journalists deal with on a daily basis. You know, the question of whether to photograph somebody who's wounded or help them is the simplest sort of scenario that arises, and that's one that happens in a day-to-day consideration, but there's also the concerns of what sort of risks you want to take to get your story, what sort of news you want to present to the public, and how that might get back to the parties involved.
Can you describe the game's protagonist, Jessie DeMarco, and how you came up with her?
So Jessie grew out of the process of looking for the right character to be the window into this story. And you know, we wanted somebody who was hard-edged enough to be convincing, but also clearly not a combatant. And that's That's effectively how we, you know, came to the process of Jesse. But really, we wanted to give players a character that felt exciting and powerful in the role of being a news gatherer, someone who was active and engaged and out there to grab the story, but also, as I say, somebody who clearly wasn't a combatant, somebody who's not going to pick up an AK-47 and start blasting away.
Now, you said the player is able to make a decision like choosing between photographing somebody who's wounded or helping them. What other decisions can the player make, and what else can Jesse do?
So right at the core is the decisions of what do you film. There's a little bit of that video that shows the introductory sequence where you arrive on the plane, and there's three or four different story threads that run through that environment that you can pick up on. So you might want to do a story that's primarily about the combat. You may want to do a story that's about the lives of the soldiers. You might want to do a story about the supplies that are coming in from NATO to supply the government troops. And you might want to do a human interest story that's about a woman who's lost her daughter. All of those elements are touched on in that space. And at every point in Warco, those decisions about the sort of story you craft are the fundamental underpinning.
Are there any consequences or repercussions because of the choices the player makes?
To my mind, games are an interesting way to tell this sort of story because they can be consequential, because they can show the results of your actions. And we've spent a lot of time looking at the way the overall plot winds and turns back on itself in order to show you the results of the decisions you've made, from interviews with child soldiers that might put them in danger to the information that you pass across, to the information that you broadcast and the way that's received, to the people that you help, to the questions that you ask. All of these have ongoing consequences through the narrative, and that's the most important part about the game to us.
You say on your website that players are able to share their stories with global audiences. What do you hope will come from players sharing their stories?
That's an interesting question. I think any time you go social, you open up an entire world of possibility. So the thing I'm hoping will come from us enabling players to share their story with other people is something that surprises me. I'm most delighted when a game or a product that we've produced enables a result that I didn't anticipate. And I think that's something that's going to come out of the editing and story building capacities that exist in Warco.
Right now, Japhet says he's in discussions with various publishers and has not yet set a release date for Warco. For War News Radio, I'm Max Nesterak.
This is War News Radio. War News Radio has now heard four parts of Alan Zhao and Jared Nolan's summer research project on Afghanistan's economy. We thought we'd catch up with them to hear more broadly about the making of the series. So, tell me about the project.
Well, this project took a lot of twists and turns before we finally figured out what we wanted to do. We were definitely handicapped by the amount of information available on Afghanistan. I mean, raw data just doesn't exist in any usable form. If you go to the World Bank's website and look at the data they have, whether it's unemployment rate or GDP growth or school enrollment, there are huge gaps with years missing all over the place. There is, though, a decent amount of literature out there with various aspects of Afghanistan's economy. So ultimately, we decided that a comprehensive report that compiled all the information out there into an easily understandable report would be the most useful product.
That was Jared Nolan. So, Alan, how did you guys get all of your information?
So we talked to leading experts in the field to supplement our knowledge, and that formed the basis of our pieces, which focused on six different topics: foreign aid, opium, financial institutions, mining, transportation, and agriculture.
So what did you two find as the most interesting topics in your series?
For me, it would definitely be opium, because it's just been so underreported by the media. For example, I never knew it consisted up to 50% of the country's total GDP. But what was really surprising was the fact that production hasn't changed in the past 10 years of U.S. intervention. You would think that with all the billions we've spent on aid, we would have something to show for it, but we don't. The reason behind opium both being so economically dominant and so hard to eliminate are really, really complicated, but I think my pieces give a good overview.
Right, and what about you, Jared?
For me, it's the complexity of the aid situation. There's so much potential there for both success and failure. I mean, the desire to make things better for Afghans is definitely there, but it's not clear how much of an impact the big aid projects are actually having. In fact, it could actually be a negative effect. On top of all the corruption and waste, bringing a lot of aid money to communities can cause a lot of conflict between people trying to channel the money their way. The only method that's unconditionally successful is giving villages small grants to implement projects they need. The only problem is those projects can't deliver the major impact Afghanistan needs to solve all its issues.
But those are just broad overviews of our two favorite topics. We actually found a lot of really shocking facts within every topic.
Can you give me an example?
Well, according to one report I read, over 40% of the aid money Afghanistan receives actually goes back to the donor country through international consultants and contractors. The standard model of development just isn't working.
Well, this doesn't really come from any specific topic, but the most shocking fact I read was about the chief of Afghanistan's anti-corruption administration. I can't really say his name correctly, but it's something like Izzatullah Wasifi. And basically, he was arrested 20 years ago in Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas trying to sell $2 million worth of street heroin.
Oh my gosh.
He actually ended up spending 3 years in U.S. prison. But I think it says a lot about the country when someone like that is at the head of getting rid of corruption.
It certainly does. So overall, what conclusions did you come to?
Basically, Afghanistan is a complex environment. When we started on this project, we simply wanted to assemble a broad overview of the country's economy with some analysis into a few unique sectors. We figured that such a backward and underdeveloped country would provide straightforward answers to its problems. It was just a matter of looking in the right place. What we found, though, is a deeply complicated and intertwined country where cause doesn't equal effect.
It's pretty depressing, but the common themes we found throughout were corruption and political instability. If we pull out not just militarily, but also financially, in 2014, then Afghanistan has the potential to turn into a Central Asian Somalia.
So what are the implications of that? Or what do you want listeners to take away?
The bottom line is, as much as people want to make it black and white, you know, stay in or pull out, there's really no easy answer. You can't focus on a single issue such as poverty or corruption or insecurity, because to solve one, you must solve them all.
Well, Jared and Alan, thank you so much for your time. So in addition to the radio segments, you can also find a link to their summer research project on our website, warnewsradio.org.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Kate Aronoff, Amy DiPiero, Rosanna Kim, Stuart Russell, and Colin Smith. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Caroline Batten.
And I'm Eliana Biscard-Church. Until next time, thanks for listening.